We are very pleased here at the KITP to have our very own Paul Hansma to give us a colloquium today. In fact, the very first 3D colloquium that I know of. So after a long and distinguished career, Paul retired from the physics department recently, but has continued to pursue his research on bone fracture. He's probably the only one here on the faculty to have gone literally from Broider, the physics building, for those of you who do not know, to bedside. So before I let Paul speak, I might perhaps mention that among his very many interests, Paul is also a very talented photographer who recently generously shared some of his work with the physics department. So here's Paul Hansma. That hammer looks kind of dangerous.
All right, thank you, Tony. I'm very glad to be here today and be able to tell you about some of the gadgets I built recently. I really enjoy building gadgets, and sort of my career has been centered around building gadgets. I built a lot of atomic force microscopes, and I was very happy. There was a recent conference, Seeing at the Nanoscale, sponsored by Bruker, and they gave me a boxed example of one of the microscopes that came from the UCSB patent that they had commercialized. And it said that this microscope, which is still in production, had enabled 14,000 publications. And so that's one of the things that warms the heart of a gadget builder, to hear that their gadgets are out there and working well. And so the gadgets that I'll tell you about today, which I hope may have even a bigger impact, are being commercialized by Active Life Scientific, which was started from right here at UCSB, and so I'll say some more about that. Because for a gadget builder, it's good to be associated with a company so that your gadgets can get out in the world, you know, and help people. So from Broida to bedside, from fundamental clinical research to on bone fracture. Well, my research on this started in collaboration with Dan Morse and Galen Stuckey. And at the very start of the materials research lab, the grant that went in there, we proposed to try to figure out why it was that an abalone shell, which was 97% crystalline calcium carbonate, was 3,000 times more fracture resistant than crystalline calcium carbonate. How that 3% of organic in this shell gave it such incredible increase in fracture resistance. We wanted to figure that out. And what we found out was that one of the real keys to it is a molecular mechanistic principle called sacrificial bonds and hidden length. And that's been something that's really been a focus of our research and gadget building ever since, sacrificial bonds and hidden length. So I'd like to show you how that happens. We saw this phenomenon in abalone shell, then we saw it in muscle Bissell threads, then we saw it in diatoms, and we saw it in silica sponges. And after we'd seen it enough times, I started wondering, well, for humans, the most important biomineral is not abalone shells, it's bone. And I wonder if the same principle might happen in bone. When we submitted the original manuscript on sacrificial bonds and hidden length to Nature, Philip Ball actually came up with a better title than we submitted. His title was Molecular Mechanistic Origin of the Toughness of Natural Fibers, Adhesives, and Composites. And that has turned out to be true. This is a very widespread mechanism. I'd like to tell you how it works by showing it to you in the case of bone. So in the case of bone, what happens is if you expose the organic layer, if you just actually just take bone and you can just shave it off with a knife or just anything to expose the fresh surface of bone and then come down with the tip of an atomic force microscope, you can do something called molecular pulling. And what you can do is you can lower that down there and you can pull up and you can measure force versus distance of the little molecules you pull up. You can do this with single molecules because the atomic force microscope is sensitive enough for that. And if you do it on bone, what you see is that the force will go up and then drop, up and then drop, up and then drop, up and then, it just repeats. And we studied it depending on how long you dwelled on the surface before you pulled the next time. The longer you dwell, the more area between the curves you get. In other words, the more energy dissipation you have through this cycle. We studied its dependence on different ions. Now, the way this principle works, I'll show you in a model in here. The basic idea is if you have a polymer adhesive, like in the case of the abalone shell, it's a long protein. If you have a long polymer that's gluing together two things, like the little plates in the abalone shell, the problem is that you only really get a restoring force, you only really get elasticity when you're pretty near the stretched length of the protein. Now, what happens is there's something called entropic elasticity. That's to say, if the two ends are close together, there's many, many more configurations for this than if you're stretched out. So stretching out, you reduce the entropy of this, and you have to work to do that. But you only have to start working pretty far out, so it's not really good for gluing together a composite. But Mother Nature has come up with this trick, this secret, of sacrificial bonds and hidden length. The idea is, what if you tie up some of the length of that protein with bonds that effectively shorten it and hide some of the length, like this red length is hidden? So we can do that here. We can take this length and we can hide it by making a sacrificial bond like that. And then we can make multiple ones of these. We'll hide this length with this sacrificial bond. We'll hide this length with this sacrificial bond. And so now we have a lot of hidden length. As far as the two ends are concerned, it's like we have a short polymer. So we reach that restoring force right away. Now, when you start pulling on this thing, what happens is the force goes up, 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 and then it drops, just like you saw in the force diagram, right? The beauty is now you have to do all the work against entropic elasticity again until you come up. Now the next sacrificial bond breaks. We call them sacrificial bonds because they break, they sacrifice themselves before the backbone will break. Because if the backbone breaks, you're out of luck. Right? Stretch it a little more, and any other one breaks. Now the beauty of this mechanism is, in nature, that when the external force that's tending to break this structure goes away, entropic elasticity will condense it back again. And this doesn't always work. But if we're lucky, we'll form some more sacrificial bonds in the few seconds, which is about what it takes naturally. Perfect. Perfect, you see? So again, we have sacrificial bonds and hidden length. Now, the pattern is going to be a little different than the first time. And you saw that in the data. You saw that each time it looks a little random and different because these bonds form random and differently. But the point is that you suck out a huge amount of energy from whatever is trying to fracture the system with these sacrificial bonds and hidden length, because the work to stretch the hidden length is of order 100 times the work to break a weak sacrificial bond. And this is one of the things you can see. This working against polymer entropic elasticity is a great recipe for fracture resistance. Think about an automobile tire where this happens. You can beat on an automobile tire with a hammer all day long. You're not going to fracture it. But take the strongest, almost strongest bonds in nature, like in a diamond. I know from experience, you can put it between two hardened steel plates, tap it with a hammer, and shatter it, because we did it in the early days of AFM. So really strong bonds don't give you a fracture-resistant material. Ironically, in weakness there is strength, so to speak. Having these sacrificial bonds makes the material much more fracture resistant. Now, from this, the research in my group has gone a number of different directions. One of the directions that I was just working on before I came over here is kind of not what you'd expect. When I was at UCSF Medical School working on some of the devices I'm going to be telling you about, I got a call from Chancellor Yang, and he said he was interested whether the principle of sacrificial bonds and hidden length could be used to design actuators to protect buildings from earthquakes, from damage in earthquakes. Boy, talk about off the wall thinking, you know, or creative thinking. I thought, well, maybe, I don't know. And that started a research project. We have a grant now, we're working on it, and it's working very, very well. Today it's really working great up in the lab, these new gadgets that we've made based on this principle involving no organic materials whatsoever, but using the basic principles of having this force versus distance curve, which you can't get from dampers or friction. It's a novel force versus energy curve that resists you coming out, but then let's go back easily. Makes a lot of energy dissipation. So that's one direction that's gone from this, not the direction I'll talk about today. Another direction that went from this is trying to figure out where are these molecules in bone. In abalone shell, it was easy enough. There's all these mineral plates, and the molecules are between the mineral plates. Bone is a much more complex material. Bone is one-third by volume, one-third mineral, one-third organic, and one-third water. It's much more complex structure, as you'll see in a minute. And so track down where are these molecules, what are these molecules. I'll say a little bit about that today. But mostly what I'll talk about today is in response to a challenge I got from a distinguished thought leader in bone named Adolfo Diaz Perez. I think I'll keep you in suspense about that challenge for a few more slides while I go to talking about what bone is like and where these molecules are. If you look at bone with an atomic force microscope, these are images taken in Broida Hall by Johannes Kint, one of my graduate students. You see that you have mineralized collagen fibrils. Now, when he dissolved away the mineral particles, you can see the underlying collagen fibrils, which are very distinctive because of this banding, which is 67 nanometer banding. But in nature, in your body, the bone is covered with these tiny mineral plates. The mineral plates in bone are very small, which is why it's so hard to study bone, one of the reasons. In abalone shells, they're maybe 10 microns across. In bone, they're 100 nanometers across, so about the width of the fibril are these little plates, and they're thin. They're just a few unit cells thick. Tiny, tiny particles make up bone. So where does this fit in the structure? Bone is a hierarchically ordered material. I'm just going to go quickly through 9 orders of magnitude looking at bone of the two types, cortical and trabecular. You go through 9 orders of magnitude to get from this length scale to that length scale, and you got stuff that's going on at almost every one of those orders of magnitude. This is what's meant by a hierarchically structured material. Very, very complex. Now, at this length scale, bone is very, very well studied and understood. There's a lot of good tools for investigating bone at this length scale. You have x-rays, you have MRI, you have optical microscopy, lot of tools. This is very well understood. And bone is also very well understood at this level. You have collagen molecules, and they wrap into triple helixes, and there's mineral plates in between them. This you can get from x-ray diffraction and so on, and biochemical techniques. But it turned out there was kind of a missing zone right in here where there was not much information. In fact, it wasn't until our work that people recognized that there were mineral plates on the outside of the collagen fibrils and that these mineral plates were important for bone fracture resistance. People just knew about the mineral plates inside. So, I mean, you think about a field of bone, like there's 6,000 people who go to the one annual meeting of the bone community. But it's kind of amazing that people had never known that, really. And so we kind of filled in a gap in bone. And you think about this gap because this gap is really important for fracture. Think about, like, right here, if you took a cross-section, you have these fibrils which are more or less round, coated with particles, and in between them, they can't space fill. So in between them, there's a gel matrix. There's where the water in the bone is. And there are also these organic molecules with sacrificial bonds and hidden length in the gel matrix. And how is that related to bone fracture? Well, let me show you what happens when bone fractures. When bone fractures, it begins right at this length scale in here. The collagen fibrils, mineralized collagen fibrils, they don't come apart. They stay as a unit. But what happens is they separate. So here you can see at the highest magnification, these mineralized collagen fibrils starting to separate. And this is what happens when bone begins to fracture. And so if you want to ask what gives bone fracture resistance, you're asking what holds them together. Now, this fracture mechanism would be called fiber pullout in a conventional composite material and be attributed to bonding failure at the fiber matrix interface. So in other words, the fibers in the bone are these mineralized collagen fibrils, and the interface to the matrix is right here, and bonding failure at that matrix. And so here we have the glue within our bones. This was another thing that came from an editor, actually. What resists the separation of mineralized collagen fibers, we believe it's the glue within our bones, and that this glue is what contains these sacrificial bonds and hidden length. And if we look at even higher resolution images, you can sometimes see remnants of that glue. This has been dried down for scanning electron microscopy, so what had been a distributed network of molecules in water has kind of condensed down to these threads. But you see these threads kind of joining together, mineralized collagen fibrils and bundles of collagen fibrils. So about the time that I was presenting this kind of work at bone conferences, there was one bone conference in Rome. And after my talk, a distinguished physician named Adolfo Diaz Perez came up to me. He's a real thought leader in the bone community. And he said to me that he thought this work was very interesting, and that he thought that it was possible that this kind of mechanism contributed to fracture resistance and the lack of the mechanism contributed to bone fragility. But, he said, I needed to realize that my work was clinically irrelevant. Clinically irrelevant? Geez, I thought, you know, bone fracture, big clinical problem, how could this be clinically irrelevant? But he was absolutely right. The point is, there was no way to measure the bone material properties that contribute to fracture resistance in patients. And if you can't measure something in patients, it's clinically irrelevant. You have to be able to measure it in patients. So that's your only hope of understanding how big an effect is. It's your only hope of developing a cure, right? So if you can measure it in patients, you can see if the drug that you give is helping or hurting. So I took this kind of as a challenge. As I said at the beginning, I like to build gadgets. And so this seemed like a good challenge for building a gadget that could measure these bone material properties relevant to fracture risk in living patients. But where to begin? But before I get into that story, Tony promised you a little bit of practical information about bone at the end. I'm putting it here. It's a kind of a transition because I want to say what was clinically relevant at that time, what people do in the clinic for bone fragility. And the point is that bone loss is quantified with x-rays, DEXA, dual energy x-ray absorption. And this measures how much bone a patient has, basically. It measures bone mineral density, which is grams per square centimeter of calcium in the path of the beam. So it's a measure of how much bone you have. And patients with some bone loss are called osteopenic. With more bone loss, they're called osteoporotic. Bone loss is treated with drugs such as Fosamax and Boniva, which are bisphosphonates, estrogen or Forteo. There's a lot of different treatment options. For some of them, people worry about side effects. For the bisphosphonates, people have worried about jaw necrosis and atypical femoral fracture, which are rare but very troubling. But the bottom line is these are rare. Fracture risk can be reduced by about 50% for the osteoporotic population. Now, the problem for the physician is with people who have osteopenia. Because if the person has osteoporosis, in other words, they've got a lot of bone loss, then they should prescribe the drugs. They select the best drug for that patient. But for the patients that are osteopenic, it's not so clear whether the benefits outweigh the risks of these drugs. That wouldn't be so bad, except that the majority of hip fractures in the United States and the world happen not in the osteoporotic population, but in the osteopenic population. Why? Because there are so many more people in the osteopenic population. And so you have the situation where you don't know whether to give drugs to the population that has the most bone fractures. And we're very much hoping that this new gadget that I'll be telling you about will help physicians make decisions for osteopenic patients and decide whether or not they need therapies, and also help in the development of new therapies that would be aimed to improve bone material properties. Now, as far as practical advice, I go to a lot of these bone conferences. I hear what the thought leaders tell the physicians. If you're under 30, they say to get plenty of calcium and exercise to build up your bone. Your bone builds up till you're 30. After that, it's downhill pretty much. And the benefits of exercise and calcium are very unclear for people my age, unfortunately. I mean, it makes, you know, there just aren't good studies that show that exercise helps a lot. You'd think it should, weight-bearing exercise and so on, but anyway. But for all ages, what I do hear over and over again is that vitamin D is very important. I hear over and over that there's a crisis of vitamin D inadequacy because of sunscreen and staying indoors, and the vitamin D level of typical American is very much lower than that of, you know, the native people that spend their time outdoors, that still spend their time outdoors, which is more up in this kind of a level. And so physicians, originally they set vitamin D requirements to prevent rickets, but they now believe that a much higher dosage of vitamin D is actually good for bone health and other health issues. And so they recommend, different people respond differently to them, so they really recommend that you have your vitamin D level checked in your blood and aim for this range. For most people, this takes between 600 and 2,000 international units of vitamin D3 daily. I put the 3 in red just to emphasize that you can get vitamin D2 or D3, but you want D3 because D2, you have to be in the sun to activate. D3 is good to go without any sun exposure. The last thing is just, and probably many of you already know this, if you want to do online research on health conditions, it's best to, like insomnia, what you want to do is put in this, in Google, you want to put insomnia NIH, or insomnia Mayo, or insomnia Johns Hopkins, because that will get you to the most trustworthy information about it. The web is filled with information, so to speak, anecdotal information about cures for all sorts of maladies. And this suffers from, well, primarily suffers from a phenomenon called regression to the mean, which is that, you know, you have conditions like an achy back. Sometimes it's better, sometimes it's worse, sometimes it's better, sometimes it's worse. So what happens is people go to the doctor or the internet when it's the worst, right? No matter what they do, it gets better. So they put in, you know, this works. I was at a clinical translation lecture that was really good. The lady asked, how many in the audience are feeling sleepy? About 6 people raised their hand. She said, okay, pinch right here and hold firm pressure for 30 seconds. All right, so then about 10, 20 minutes later, she asked, how many of you who were sleepy, you know, are still sleepy? And, you know, only 2 out of the 6 raised their hand. And she said, well, this is regression to the mean. This has nothing to do with helping you for sleepiness. It's just things come and go. So the internet is filled with advice that is not trustworthy based on regression to the mean. So that's why it's good to put these in where you get placebo control and then you have controlled studies. Okay, that's the end of the practical advice. So why can existing drugs only reduce fracture risk by 50%? Perhaps because bone loss is only half the problem. Perhaps the other half of the problem is bone material properties can go bad on you. So I'd like to show you good and bad bone material strength. Here's 2 pieces of bone. Now, this one was baked to degrade the organics, but that did nothing to the calcium particles. If you look at high magnification, all those the calcium phosphate mineral crystals are the same in this piece and this piece. And so if you did DEXA on them, these two would be equivalent. These two would be equivalent. But you can see, in terms of fracture resistance, this one, it's been around in my case for a long time. If it was fresh and wet, it would be even more fracture resistant, but you can whap on it pretty good. But take this one, where you've degraded the organics, it's just, it crumbles like chalk. Right? The point being, it's conceivable that people with the same bone mineral density could have very different quality of bone. But is it true? See, nobody knew until this research, because if you can't measure it in a living patient, how can you find out if it matters or not? It's not really practical to do three-point bending on a patient. So what can be done? Well, and because three-point bending can't be done, people didn't even know when I started to try to build this gadget about what properties that were conventionally measured were important. Is elastic modulus, yield stress, toughness, you know, what matters? Nobody knew because you can't do these experiments. And so I was given the situation of how do I build an instrument that measures the contribution material properties to bone fracture resistance when I don't even know which of these properties I should be aiming for? Well, in the beginning, I started with some soup bones from the supermarket. And what I did was I wanted to have a good, strong bone and a weaker bone, so then I could try to think about what I could do that would distinguish those two bones, you know, that might work in a patient. So I needed a good bone and a bad bone, to bake it. And then I figured I'd see how high I had to put the sledgehammer to make it break, that this would be simulate sort of bone fracture. And so I put the bones in the oven, which I do not suggest. Do not want to do this in your home oven. The house was just filled with a stench from this baked bone. It was just horrible. But I only had to do it once, and I had a lot of good bone, bad bone. And so then the game was clear. I'll take this one. I had to raise the sledgehammer 5 times before it broke, the one that was not baked at all. Where up here, when I baked it at the highest temperature, I could take the sledgehammer just a few centimeters and went. So, and I had bone baked at different temperatures. So first I could try to distinguish, you know, easy to distinguish, and then get, you know, more and more difficult to distinguish and try to make the instrument work for that. So the first success came from an automatic center punch. I don't know how many of you have used one of these things. How many of you have used an automatic center punch? Okay, quite a few of you. It's used by machinists and others to make an indent for where you want to drill a hole. So you press down on it, and all of a sudden it goes pop, and it makes an indent. And so I did that on the bone, and what I noticed was on the control bone, the indents were smaller than on the baked bone. So this seemed promising. Now, of course, it can't be used just as this, you know, on a patient. In the first place, you'd have to surgically expose the bone in order to see how big an indent you made. And in the second place, the indents would be too big. Ironically, I was just using an automatic center punch the other day to make one of these gadgets for the Henry Yang collaboration to protect buildings from earthquakes. I had an automatic center punch. I had a piece up like this, wham, right through my finger with an automatic center punch. But it's healed. It's healed. It's great. Anyway, you wouldn't want to do this on a patient. So what can you do? What could be sort of like that? Well, the next one I built was like this. I thought, well, what if you had a reference point that could sit on the surface of the bone, and then you had a test probe, and you could sort of knock the test probe and see how far it went in relative to the reference probe sitting on the surface of the bone. So this was the first reference point indentation device for measuring bone. I quickly realized that it's actually much better than having 2 points to have a hypodermic needle be the reference point, and then inside the hypodermic needle can have an indenter. And so this shows the reference point sitting on the surface of the bone and the indenter indenting the bone. And so then, without seeing the indent, you can measure the distance because, you know, you have a reference point to measure it from. So I like to make mistakes as rapidly as possible, and so in a period of a few months built a series of prototypes in my garage, coupling some of them. I brought one here. I brought one like this. This one was kind of a nice one. Basically, the way this one worked was you had the hypodermic needle for the reference probe, the center thing, and then you had a dropping weight, so you could lift this up and drop the weight, and you could see how far it went in. Okay. It would. And in fact, when I first presented this to an audience, it was at a bone conference in Sun Valley, Idaho, a physician sitting in the front row said to me, "You can never do that. You know, the periosteum is just filled with nerve cells. If you tried this on a patient, it would hurt so much. This is totally impractical. You could never do this." And I think, oh, shit. I mean, that's too bad. But afterwards, a man named Robert Recker, who's done a huge number of the clinical trials on the bone drugs that exist now, he's a real thought leader in the field. He came up, he said, no, don't worry about it at all. He said, a shot of local anesthesia, and person never feel anything. They do bone biopsies where they, you know, cut a big opening. He said, it's no problem, local anesthesia. So that maintained my hope for a while. And as you'll see, I found out myself if it hurt soon. This shows kind of the instrument in action. So you put it down on a piece of bone, and you press go, and it'll trace out a complete force versus distance curve. So the force goes up, it holds it to measure creep, and comes down. I ended up building something this fancy rather than just sticking with this, because the idea was, if it was going to be measured on patients such as myself, I really wanted to be sure the measurements were worthwhile, so I wanted to measure as much as possible. So notice now I've put on a little piece of red rubber, and the probe goes right through the red rubber down onto the bone and measures basically the same curve. So that's simulating measuring a bone covered by skin, and where clinically all the measurements are done are on the tibia. If you feel your own tibia, you'll see that the skin is very thin there, and the bone is relatively flat, so it's a good place to go. So about at this point, we make the transition from Broida to bedside, and really key to that transition was Alex Proctor and Davis Brimer, who are sitting somewhere right around here. Where are you guys? There they are. Winning the New Venture competition. The technology management program in the College of Engineering here has a New Venture competition, which is a business plan competition every year, where groups of students come together and they come up with a proposal for starting a new business, and they set up a table, and the investors come and they invest play money in the ventures that they think have the best chance of success, right? And whoever gets the most play money gets real money. And Davis and Alex won, and they won this real money. And it turned out, though, even more important than that was that they had not only convinced the investors that this was a good idea, but they convinced themselves and started the company with this money. And it's things have been going very well for the company, as you'll see. Now this is one of the first benefits of starting the company. They got to be tested by Adolfo Diaz Perez. This is the physician who told me that the problem with my research was that it was clinically irrelevant. And so after I had an instrument to measure bone in patients, though, he was enthusiastic. He wrote a grant overnight and submitted it to a Spanish funding agency and got it funded. He had the great idea that in his hospital, he was the director of internal medicine, we got a lot of patients who've had hip fractures. We got a lot of patients who are age matched who've not had hip fractures. Let's just see if their bone's different, the patients who get hip fractures from others. And so we went there and started using the instrument. I was the first animal tested with the instrument. And I can tell you, I really wondered, like, you know, it cycles. I wondered if I'd be able to feel the cycles or anything like that. But with the local anesthesia, the local anesthesia is all I felt. You feel the local anesthesia, but after that, nothing. I've been tested 100 indents by 4 different physicians. The only pain I ever experienced was as I was walking back from the hospital the first day I was tested by Adolfo. All of a sudden, there was this burning pain in my eye. Some sunscreen had dripped down. But other than that, it's okay. So here's Davis being tested. There's Alex in the background looking a little apprehensive because he's going to be tested next. And what you see when you test a patient like this is curves like this. Here's the force versus distance curve. And you notice for weak bone, it keeps going indenting further and further each time you go. With strong bone, it resists that indentation. And so we can measure various parameters, loading slope, unloading slope, creep, all sorts of things. One of the parameters that turned out to be interesting was indentation distance increase, how much this went from the first to the last cycle. Another was just total indentation distance. And we wanted to see which of these parameters correlated with bone fracture. Now, these results are actually taken from patients. This result is taken from a patient who had had a hip fracture, this one from an age-matched patient who had not had a hip fracture. When we were done testing ourselves enough and we were finally ready to test the first patient, went up to that room. Boy, that was an intense situation for me. So gets the patient anesthetized, starts going, and as it went, I saw the thing just going into the bone like I had never seen before, the indentation. And my first thought was, you know, fear. I think, oh my God, you know, I hope we don't hurt this patient. But then I realized that, well, you know, there is a limit of 1 millimeter. It can't go beyond, there's a mechanical stop. It can't go beyond 1 millimeter. My second thought was gratitude. It was like, oh my God, this thing is going to work. This patient is very, very different from the patients that we've tested. The people we've tested, such as myself and Davis and Alex and Roberto and so on. So this is the most important slide of the whole talk. Each one of those dots is one of those elderly women in a hospital bed. It turned out that that first woman we tested was one of these ones that had a big total indentation distance. But as we continued and tested more, and it was, you know, I mean, it really showed the importance of this device to me as we were doing this, because like in the Hospital Del Mar, it's not that big a hospital, but the entire third floor was patients with hip fractures. We found it easier to find patients that had hip fractures that were there in the hospital than to find the controls that were age matched. This is a huge medical problem, hip fractures in elderly people. It causes huge hospital stays. And the problem is, say, there's a higher mortality from having a hip fracture than if you have a heart attack, 1 year mortality. The problem is not that the hip fracture necessarily kills you, but that you're in the hospital for too long. Hospitals are not good places to be. Infections, that kind of stuff. So anyway, these are elderly women in the hospital bed. The other thing that was interesting about this to me was the reaction of these patients after they were tested. Now, pretty much everyone would flinch a little from the local anesthesia. Never any problem from the indentation itself. But after it was all over, they thanked the doctor. They thanked the doctor. Very interesting. You notice that people that had total indentation distances greater than 40 microns, all of them were in the fracture case. Less than 30 microns were all in the non-fracture case. In between 30 and 40, it's mixed. These were the preliminary results that were presented in the first poster. Since that time, this study has been extended to many, many more patients. They're up to 100 patients, over 100 patients now. But the trend has continued like you see it now. There's a real difference between the bone material properties such as this total indentation distance between patients with and without fractures. In fact, it's more statistically significant than the difference between the DEXA scores. but independent. They're independent measures, but this is a big factor. It's a big factor. So now the question is known. Do bone material properties contribute to fracture risk? Yes, they do. And they can be measured. Now, how does it work? Here's where your 3D glasses come in. If you can still find them, hopefully. Yeah, put them on, I think. Let's see, you have to get them on the right way. Someone who is working well for is the blue on your right eye or left eye? Blue on the right eye. And what you can see when you get it working is one of these indentations compared to the smallest U.S. coin, a dime. And so the purpose of this is, with the 3D especially, you can see this is a tiny indentation. In fact, the reference probe makes a bigger indentation than this. You know, people put screws into bone. That's one of the nice things about bone, that bone is very crack tolerant, and people put screws in bone. This is nothing compared to that. So there's never been any complication from this, despite hundreds of patients tested by now. All the same, if you do look at higher magnification at the indent, you can see that the bone is being fractured. The bone is being fractured. And so that's basically how this thing works, which is the more easily the bone is fractured, the further the probe goes in. Right? And so what you're really saying with these patients is that patients whose bone is more easily microscopically fractured are more likely to have a hip fracture. And that there's some kind of global bone quality. You measure it in the tibia, but what you look at is the hip fracture. Speaking of which, just for those of you who don't happen to know, when you talk about a hip fracture, what really breaks is the neck of the femur. So I just passed this around. You can see this neck of the femur starting to break in this one. The other bone fracture that's really bad is collapsing vertebrae. It bends people over, causes nerve pain, stuff like that. Those are the two bone fractures that are most troublesome. Yes. Yes.
Is the scatter between 30 and 40? Is that how I interpret
it? Is what?
Is the scatter between 30 and 40 on that plot? Do you make multiple measurements?
We do make multiple measurements on the same person. And in fact, Dr. Halko-Pakin here has been helping us a lot deciding how many measurements to make. Of course, from a statistical point of view, you'd like as many as possible. And from a patient comfort point of view, you'd like as few as possible. I always used to think we'd like to do it in one measurement, until I was tested the first time. And I'd gone through all the trouble of bringing the instrument there and being on the table and having my legs sterilized, local anesthesia injected, all this kind of stuff. And then the first measurement was made, and sort of it was nothing. So I mean, I'm here. Keep going, right? I mean, and so typically now between 5 and 20 measurements are being made. In Barcelona, they'll tend to make 5 measurements on patients. At the Mayo Clinic, their most recent one, they do 10 measurements, then set the instrument down, pick it up again, and do another 10 measurements. So you look at the mean of those. And
so what's the scatter relative to on that plot? If you go back to your plot, your data,
yeah.
I'm curious, what's the
scatter on a multiple patient? Like I would say on this patient, probably this is an average of all their measurements, and their measurements are probably going between sort of this kind of a range. Sort of plus or minus 10 maybe, something like that. And this is the average. Yeah. This shows a higher magnification view, also 3D. And so here you see in actual bone fracture, this is some of our early bone fracture results. You see this separation of the mineralized collagen fibrils. Here you see one of these microscopic fractures that's made by the reference point indenter. And you see you're probing the same kind of thing. You're probing how resistant the bone is to the opening of these cracks and how well these mineralized collagen fibrils help resist opening cracks in the bone. Okay, so these results were published in the leading bone journal, Journal of Bone and Mineral Research, showing the indenter and showing a colored indentation. There's Adolfo Diaz Perez, the lead author from Spain. From here, there have been multiple new directions. A commercial version of the instruments now being used, new type of reference point indenter, larger clinical study confirmed and extended the original study, theoretical work on modeling fracture, high resolution imaging, experimental. I want to say just a little bit about each of those. We'll start here. Here's the Biodent, which is the commercial version of that instrument from Active Life Scientific. And here are some of the institutions that are using it now. Very good research going on, especially at Harvard and UCSF in particular, and at Purdue. But a lot of institutions now have the instrument and are starting to use it and trying to understand, now that you know this is important, that how do you improve it? You know, what different diseases affect it? There's a lot of basic research to be done now that you know that it's important. Another direction is that we've made a simpler instrument. I mentioned I wanted the complex instrument because I didn't want to miss any difference between the two. But what it turned out was total indentation distance was about the best distinguisher between the two. And so I thought, well, if we're only going to be measuring total indentation distance, why not go to a much simpler instrument? And came up with this one, which we call the osteoprobe. I'll pass it around without a probe. It's very much like that original automatic center punch, except that it has electronics such that it can measure the indentation distance from the impact. We figured out how to do that. This shows Connor Randall and Dan Bridges, who worked on that. And this instrument went from a sketch on yellow line paper to clinical applications in less than 1 year, thanks to Connor and Dan and, you know, Adolfo. I mean, there was a real, they knew now there was a difference between the patients and the controls. They wanted to do a lot of measurements on a lot of conditions. That older instrument was kind of cumbersome for patients because you had to have a big stand to hold it, and you had to have it stationary for the 10 seconds of the measurement. But this one is just, you know, a millisecond. It's much easier to use and gives results that distinguish the two populations just as well. It can also be used on standing horses. Now here you see Kevin, one of Chancellor Yang's graduate students, with Doug Herthel, a really good veterinarian, and they're testing horses. Bone fracture is a problem not only for humans, but also for horses, a big problem for horses. And this instrument can be used on standing horses. The reason that Kevin and Chancellor Yang are involved in this has to do with they've been studying the cutting of materials at Purdue in collaboration with a man named Chandra Sekar. And they have optimized cutting strategies for ordinary materials, and they wanted to extend that to bone. And so they asked me if I wanted to be involved in the grant to do that, and I was enthusiastic because their collaboration included a veterinarian there who had access to horses for testing and so on. And so I was enthusiastic, and that began that aspect of our collaboration. Now, Davis has compiled a list of 100 known diseases that increase the risk of bone fracture, and over 1,450 drugs with side effects known to increase the risk of fracture. It's a huge problem, and there's a lot of things to study. A lot of things to study, some of which are already in plan. Studies are already planned or underway. For example, diabetes type 2 is being studied as we speak at the Mayo Clinic using the osteoprobe. Glucocorticoid steroid-induced osteoporosis is being studied in Barcelona. This is very dramatic. It turns out that the big doses of steroids that are sometimes given to organ transplant patients to help them recover from that, they can make the bone go bad within weeks. It's very dramatic and scary. We're making instruments and sending them mostly to Europe, some to the United States, to look at all these sorts of conditions. There's a lot of stuff to do. There's been some theoretical work. Ahmed, who worked with Jim Langer and Gene Carlson, has tried to go from sacrificial bonds and hidden link and step up toward the whole bone structure. And this is one of his recent results. He's now at the University of Illinois working with Charles Liao, This is one of their results. It shows that it has to do with sacrificial bonds hindering increased flaw tolerance. I mentioned to you that bone can have little cracks in it, and it does. It has cracks all over the place. But the question is, will these cracks grow into fractures? And so this shows this, yield, the stress. And this shows a normalized stress. This is a normalized crack length. And basically what you see is at any crack length, the stress necessary to propagate that crack is greater if you have these glue molecules present than if you don't have the glue molecules present. And so the hope is this kind of research can further elucidate how these molecules work to increase the fracture resistance of this very complex hierarchically ordered material. This shows some theoretical work from Kevin and Chancellor Yang. I don't know how many of you know, but Chancellor Yang was actually one of the pioneers of finite element analysis. He was doing it back in the days of paper tape for the computers. And he, for instance, did the finite element analysis of the containment vessel for Three Mile Island, which did hold. And since that time, he's a real expert. And for instance, one of his great contributions here was helping Kevin get an optimized grid for studying this problem of indentation into bone, rather than just a naive grid that has equally spaced nodes all over the place, has this nice grid here, which vastly decreases computation time. Now, the importance of this work was that it makes connection with the conventional mechanical measurements. There's a huge body of work on conventional mechanical measurements on bone, and a lot is known by that community. Now, it can't be measured on patients, but cadaver bone, a huge amount of information is known. Now we know that this indentation distance is clinically relevant. How can we connect this huge body of information to what we now know is important in patients? Well, this is the answer. At first, people had the hope that, well, it might just be one thing. You know, maybe just toughness, or maybe it was just yield stress. But it looks like, though, in some cases, toughness is correlated with the indentation distance. David Burr has found that out in a recent study. It's more complex than that. It involves multiple factors. Bone can go bad for many different reasons. And the beauty of this work is that it puts in conventionally measured mechanical properties of bone that Kevin measures himself, and then does the finite element analysis using those, and comes up with predictions, experiment, and theory, which are very good to my eye, given the fact that there are no adjustable parameters. And we've also been looking more at bones. Here's some bone. When we measure with the osteoprobe, we actually normalize the indentation distance and invert it and get a measure called bone material strength. 100 is really good. 50 is really bad. Sorry, it's not 3D. Won't help. But this is good bone. These are two 83-year-old women, bone from two 83-year-old donors. This one was good, 94.4. This is kind of like grades, you know, 90%. That's good. Her bone, you notice, has all this crack bridging by these mineralized collagen fibrils. And when Heather Barnard looked with a custom AFM that she built, it's hard to look at a fractured bone surface. It's one thing to look at a smooth surface, but fractured bone was much more difficult. But she built an AFM in our lab that did it. And you can see as you look here that the bone, you're starting to open multiple interfaces in the bone, multiple interfaces that are bridged by these mineralized collagen fibrils. And this is an excellent way to dissipate energy if you open multiple interfaces rather than just one. Other tissues are also being investigated. This was done when I was up at UCSF, and this is on spinal discs. And for instance, here we can put a probe similar to the one I showed you, but longer, into a spinal disc. And this is the annulus of the spinal disc toward the outside. This is the nucleus of the spinal disc. You can plot the mechanical properties as you go in. That was published here. And then they published another paper that was much more exciting because they were actually able to show that they were able to distinguish painful discs from non-painful discs, which was something that hadn't been possible with, with MRI or CAT scans. And so they were excited about that. And there's a lot of other tissues in the human body where there's pathologies. And you know that, like, if you go to the doctor for your exam, he's kind of, you know, feeling you, palpating and so on. And he's looking for mechanical changes in tissues that he can feel. Well, what this is kind of a instrumented, quantified palpation, if you like. And they go into the tissue, and you can actually measure the mechanical properties of a buried tissue. Now, of course, you're sticking a needle into the body, and so it's got to be worth it, right? But it's definitely an area for future growth of trying to understand tissue mechanics of other tissues in the body as well. So in summary, basic research on bone pointed to the need for a new clinical instrument. A reference point indentation instrument can assess the contribution of material properties to whole bone fracture risk in patients. Many human diseases are associated with changes in material properties of tissue. Now there's hope of measuring these changes in patients. And of course, once you can measure it, then you can try to improve it with nutrition, drugs, exercise. And I'd like to thank the people who helped in the work, pretty much all of whom I mentioned as I was presenting the work. So I'll just leave this up here. And thank you very much for your attention.
Yes. Experimental evidence.
Yes.
There clearly were two populations.
Yes.
A lot of fracture patients that showed no difference.
Yes.
So are you thinking of other instruments?
No.
Other kinds of stress aside from just puncture, that might cover the other elements of musculoskeletal.
What a great question. Yeah. Maybe I'll give a talk in 10 years and talk about that as inspiration for a new instrument. No, I haven't thought too much about it, frankly. I've been kind of swept away with trying to get these instruments made and shipped to the collaborators, you know, to do the measurements with these, and trying to get the instruments all the same. This is something that's new for me, you know, trying to make instruments that are the same so the different collaborators can compare their results. But that's an intriguing idea to think about whether they can be further distinguished. Thanks. Not yet, but this is research that is going to be ongoing and that I'm really excited about. I mean, one example of that, Philip Turner, who was in our lab and is now a professor in England, he's been working on mice models of mice that are missing the genes for making, or the genes are blocked so that they don't express osteopontin, which is one of the molecules that we think is the glue. And so he's been measuring the properties of the bones of the mice with osteopontin versus without osteopontin. And there's a lot of experiments of that nature planned where they're going to have bone there's a lot of research in the medical field of, you know, this kind of genetic dissection kind of thing where you knock out one protein and you see how, you know, things are different. Because unfortunately, you can't just, what I'd love to do is be able to go into bone and, you know, take out the glue, you know, or take it out one type of molecule at a time. That'd be great. But what can be done is these kinds of experiments. And of course, you know, there's some hope that theoretical explanations, such as the one you began, will give us more information about understanding the role of these and give us clues about how to improve things. There's a lot of research about how the body might use this strategy, for instance. The bone is filled with cells called osteocytes, and these osteocytes can produce the glue. And these osteocytes are linked together in a network of canaliculi, and as bone gets stressed, fluid flows through canaliculi, and it's known that fluid flow over these cells increases the production of these molecules. And so it appears that the body can have an acute healing mechanism for if the strains are too big, too much fluid flow, it can increase the amount of glue locally. And that sort of mechanism, you know, will be investigated, of course, as well as whether there's dietary supplements. And that'll probably be started mostly in the horses, because in that case, you know, you don't need FDA approval or anything like that, and it's a big problem. So, for instance, Doug Herthel, who sells Platinum Performance Plus products, wants to do a study to see if his existing product, you know, increases bone health of horses as measured by this instrument. I've kind of talked around your question because I don't know actually the answer to your question, so I said some other things sort of related. Yeah.
Has there been much study of the effect using these instruments to test the effectiveness of therapeutic approaches?
No. It's beginning, but nothing has yet been published, I don't think. I don't think so. Nothing's been published yet, but a lot of those labs that I showed the symbols with, you know, they're working on that kind of thing, and there's people working on diet, nutrition, and various. I mean, one of the things is there's a lot of drugs that are on the market that may have the benefit of increasing these properties, but you don't know because you couldn't measure it. And so there's some interest. Say Adolfo has plans for, he's looking at long-term bisphosphonate use to see what that does to these properties, and people are looking at other drugs that already are prescribed for bone to see if they have an effect on this as well as increasing the amount of bone, which is what they were designed for. And there may be some are better than others, and so on. Yeah, Gary.
Yeah, would you repeat it, measurements on the same patient?
Yes.
Is it at the same spot in the bone or various different spots?
It you vary along the bone. Basically, what they do is they'll put the needle down through the skin one place, and then you can kind of slide the skin around and do 5 measurements in one location, and then make another skin puncture if you want 5 more. And we've mapped the properties along the tibia from bone from donors, and the variation is very small. We've also looked at horses, too, along their cannon bone. The variation is very small along the bone relative to between patients. So as long as you're more or less in the center of the bone, you're okay. That's it. The scatter is the same whether you move a little bit or a lot. Yeah. Yeah, it's... I can do a little bit of that. It's true that the energy dissipation comes from entropic elasticity, and it seems to be that that you do create these kind of sacrificial bonds in the process of vulcanization. So you do create these bonds in the hidden link in the rubbers by that process. But beyond that, I don't know a lot. I don't know. It's a very, of course, different system in that you've got all organic as opposed to, you know, one third organic, one third mineral, and one third water.
Entropy is warm in terms of, you know,
Ah, good. Well, I can say a little bit about dynamic effects, which is that that's one of the interesting things about this mechanism and why it's interesting for buildings as well, because the velocity dependent of this is very small. It's logarithmic. It's very small velocity dependence compared to, say, viscous dampers, where you have a linear velocity dependence. It's one way reason you can't simulate this with viscous dampers and friction, because you've got this unusual, almost velocity independent. In fact, it's true in a lot of tissues in the body that you have this kind of velocity independent, more or less, dissipation process. The funny thing is, in books on tissue mechanics, you see all these models, sometimes with names of people, that involve various combinations of springs and dashpots and so on. At which can be, you know, they can simulate a curve done at one velocity under one set of conditions, but basically they don't work, you know, over a long range of velocities. But anyway, did you want to say something about it? Yeah. The X-rays. Fortunately, it's pretty much uncorrelated. The biggest study that's been done on that was done at the University of Oregon, where they specifically looked for that. And the correlation is positive but very weak, which that's very good, because if the correlation was very strong, then there's no point to having our instrument. Although, ironically, our instrument is actually much easier to use than DEXA. Like these patients that had the hip fractures at Barcelona, we suffered from not having the comparison on every patient, because you can do our measurement on every patient. You just go to the room and you do it. For DEXA, you have to move them onto a gurney. You have to bring them down to the DEXA room. And when they've just had a hip fracture, you can't do that. But both DEXA and this tell different things, quantity and quality. Yes. Oh, if you include DEXA? No. We still need your other device.